This is Brian Taylor, and this is number 4 in a series of 7 talks for the course The Empty Way, Zen Buddhism and Contemplative Christianity. This week in Robert Kennedy's book, Zen Gifts to Christians, chapter 4 is on impermanence and change. The picture, Catching the Ox, is from the Ox Herding series, which is a metaphor for the spiritual journey, and it has a great image of the ox herder pulling on the resistant ox's tail. The poem that accompanies this image is, Grasp the rein harder, do not let go of the ox. In this part of the story of the ox and the ox herder, faults are not yet overcome. The ox still wants to turn and go back into the wilderness. So beginning with this vivid picture, we might reflect on something. What part of you wants to resist continuing on the spiritual path at times, and why? Are you comfortable where you are? Are you too busy? Is there a fear of the unknown? What attachments do you still hold on to? And what is that wilderness for you that you return to? Now, we are all resistant. There's no shame in it. It's just a matter of degree. The idea of a perfectly willing, perfectly disciplined faith explorer is a fantasy. And those who think of themselves that way are probably most resistant of all. Having adopted a self-protective persona of having it all together as a defense against the lack of control and true mystery that lies at the heart of the spiritual journey. So we're all resistant, we're all the ox turning back to the wilderness, at least at times. But there's also something pulling us by the tail, pulling us back on the path. So again, you might reflect, what is that? Is it the call of God? Is it your own best self? Is it a sense of should? Is it your Buddha nature or Christ within you? Kennedy rather quickly shifts from resistance to the subject of impermanence, and I would have preferred that he connect the two a little more explicitly, but he doesn't, so I'll supply my own connection. Buddhism teaches that nothing exists as permanent, separate, or substantial things. Everything is in flux, evolving, being influenced by and influencing other myriad factors all the time. And that includes what we call me. Everything about what I call me is impermanent. This body, my circumstances, my moods, my thoughts, everything is changing, all will pass away. And this impermanence means that there's no state of completion, never a point where we are fully enlightened all the time, where we have permanent peace of mind, where we have arrived at our final destination. Because we are always in a process on the spiritual journey, we're always imperfect. There's always a part of us that resists the peeling away of the next layer of the onion, that always wants to keep the imagined protection of that particular layer and hold on to attachments, to not bring awareness to something. This is the ox turning away from the journey, shuffling back towards the wilderness. This is the human condition. Now, in Christianity, this theme is reinforced constantly, our imperfection, even our brokenness. And it's reinforced often to the point where there's a kind of excuse for spiritual self-satisfaction, for spiritual laziness. Buddhism also stresses the need for continual practice, that we are never perfected. There is awakening after awakening. Practice never ends. Which is to say that there's always still work to do, new self-awareness to bring to new circumstances, new, more subtle manifestations of our delusions and attachments, even after we have awakening experiences. For proof of that, we don't have to look very far, just we look at the unethical behavior of so many awakened Zen masters, just like Christian clergy. A And so we are all the ox, resistant at times, certainly imperfect. And we are also the ox herder, holding on to the tail of the ox, pulling it back on the path. Perhaps that's why some of you signed up for this class. But now let's turn to a broader view of the teaching of impermanence. We know from the study of subatomic physics that there is no such thing as solid static matter. What we see is not really there. There are trillions of particles rising, interacting, transforming, falling at a rapid, violent rate, humming, vibrating, evanescent fields of energy, only appearing to be consistent and stable. There is no substance or thing at a subatomic level. There is motion, but no mover. And none of this energy and motion ever stays the same. Everything is constantly in a process of evolution, decay, death, rebirth. Everything is in a dynamic relationship with everything else around it, influencing and being influenced by other energy clusters in motion. Now, this is true whether we're talking about a forest, the human body, nations, relationships, the circumstances of our life, the earth and its environment. All is movement and change and relationship and impermanence. Now, we may have an intellectual acknowledgement of this, but it's much more difficult to experience and to feel all of life as impermanent, especially when it comes to what we call the self. It is natural and necessary to go through life seeing ourselves as stable. We have to do that as a separate individual. You are not me and I am not you. We have to see chairs as solid so that we can sit on them with confidence. This is what Buddhism calls relative or conventional truth. We need it in order to function in the world. But if we place too much trust in this conventional truth, we will eventually be in trouble. This was the Buddha's disturbing realization when he was a young man. He had grown up as a privileged prince in a wealthy household protected from the world. And when he managed to escape that protection and go out into the village, he saw old age, illness, and death. He saw impermanence, and he was shocked that this is what happens. When we place all our trust in ourselves as a solid, permanent thing, we objectify the self. We take on a persona, an identity. We say, I am this kind of person, not that kind of person. And we might become rigid and objectified. And things around us and people around us become objects too. So we attach to things that we like or people that we like. Or we think that things that we like will keep this object, the self, safe or happy. And we avert ourselves away from things or people that we dislike or things that seem to threaten us. Attachment and aversion, a constant effort to keep solid the sense of the self and the world we live in, to keep it predictable, unchanging. As one author has put it, we mistake what is a cluster of processes for a thing. So the objectification of the world and the self is a doomed effort, for it causes us to suffer and cause suffering, constantly trying, disappointed, trying harder again and again. This is what the Buddhists call samsara, the endless cycle of attachment and aversion, the source of our suffering. And it is the teaching of the first and second noble truths. The third and fourth noble truths offer a way out of this trap, this endless cycle, where through particular practices we learn to unlearn attachment and aversion to how we want things to be, and embrace life as it is in the moment without attachment. We learn to feel and accept the impermanent fluidity of circumstances, the impermanent fluidity of what we call the self. Worldly satisfaction, pleasure, states of mind, security, health, life itself, all of it impermanent. Nothing ever remains the same forever. Nothing is solid, immutable. We are like the weather. We say, it is raining. But there is no it. There is only the raining. Similarly, there is no self, only what is experienced. There are thoughts without a thinker, feelings without a feeler. In the Christian tradition, there's plenty that points in the same direction, especially among contemplatives, which undermines the objectification of self, of God, of prayer, of circumstances. Those in the contemplative tradition say we are called to live without guarantees about how things will go for us in prayer and in life, without any image of God, without any content to our hope, not to have faith that, but rather to exercise faith, just faith, trust. Even to the point of denying the self, that is, dropping the self that is to be built up, identified with, held onto, protected, becoming, in a sense, nothing in God. John of the Cross's famous motto was nada, 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 nothing, nothing, nothing. Now, contemplatives do this by stressing detachment, detachment from circumstances, from self, from who or what we think God is or what we think God might do. The early contemplatives called this apatheia in Greek. The word apatheia is the basis for the word apathetic in English. And unfortunately, apathetic has come to mean a kind of passive indifference. But apatheia actually means literally without pathos, apatheia, without suffering or passion. And the English word equanimity is closer to the meaning of apatheia. Contemplative prayer helps us to detach from the reactivity of our passions, to experience the drama of our life as only so much weather passing across an empty sky. If we de-objectify the self and our circumstances and simply ride the waves of energy that are passing through us, we may still feel deeply, especially when things are not going well for us and for others that we love. But with contemplation, we can eventually regain some equanimity, at least an occasional perspective outside the bubble of our feelings and our life drama, where, as Julian of Norwich said, all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well. Contemplation or meditation cultivates this apatheia. Because in the intensive workshop of silence and stillness, we see the exact nature of thoughts, of feelings and sensations. They have no substance. There are waves of energy that pass through our consciousness, like clouds passing across the blue sky, or a scene from a movie playing on an empty screen. And if we do this practice regularly, it becomes more natural in our daily life, so that when we're upset, when things are not going well for us, we not only feel the upset in the moment, we also might have the capacity to not see it as a thing that has substance and permanence, and eventually to let it be what it is, a temporary wave of energy, and then return to equanimity. Now, obviously, this is much more difficult the more serious the upset. If our most beloved companion has been diagnosed with a terminal illness, we're not going to feel equanimity. But there's always the potential for some degree of this perspective. So the contemplative tradition offers contemplative prayer itself as a way of dealing with the unpredictability of life, dealing with impermanence by learning apatheia. But the Judeo-Christian tradition more broadly also deals directly with impermanence. We see it throughout the scriptures. The Israelites were 40 years in the desert with manna, the food from heaven, manna only for today. There was a cloud by day and a fire by night. No golden city visible on the horizon, just this in the desert. trust not even in what God will do, but merely trust in God. Paul had a kind of unshakable faith in the midst of impermanence, uncertainty, insecurity, even violence. That is, he had trust in something other than his temporary circumstances and his reactivity to those circumstances. We have the example of Jesus' equanimity in the midst of conflict, trial, his death on the cross, where he was able to say, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Into your hands I commend my spirit." Now, another way in which our scriptures deal with impermanence is in the refusal to make God into an object, a thing. Primary among these stories is the story of the burning bush with Moses, the first revelation of the God of Israel, the first self-revelation, I should say, of the God of Israel. This voice commands Moses to go and tell the Pharaoh to set all the slaves free, and Moses quite naturally says, "Well, who shall I say sent me?" And the answer is, "I am that I am." That's a very interesting answer. It really undermines the sense of a God who is a being. "I am that I am" suggests being itself rather than a being. And nowadays you hear theologians speaking against what they call the heresy of theism, that is, making God into a thing, making God into an object, making God into a being who is separate from creation, from us. Theism is rampant throughout Christianity, and the early scriptures, especially the story of Moses and the burning bush, challenge that. It's been challenged forever in our tradition. God is being itself. "I am that I am." The first two commandments that Moses was given speak about this mystery of God as being. "You shall have no other gods before me, and you shall make no idols for yourselves," which is to say, do not objectify me. Do not reduce me to a thing you can control or understand. Now, this theology about God says something about us and about creation as well. Creation is made in the image of the Creator. That is, all of reality, and us too, as individuals, we are made in the image, in the likeness of "I am that I am." All of creation is not a being, an object, a thing, a collection of various things, but rather being itself as one glorious process of becoming, of impermanence. So now I'd like to offer a guided meditation that might help you in the moment to experience impermanence and trust in the emptiness that remains. And again, you might restart this recording when you're settled and ready for a period of meditation. As usual, begin with uprightness, with the breath, with the awareness of your body. Ask for the Spirit's grace to support you in prayer. Knowing that the Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. As thoughts arise, see them not as you, as revealing who you are, but as mind waves that arise from the chemistry of your brain, mind waves that pass through your consciousness. Let them come and let them go. When you become aware of being caught up in a thought, you might quickly ask yourself, where is that thought now? Gone. Nowhere to be seen. Just as my words pass away as I speak them. And you might then ask, who created that thought? Again, gone. No one there. Continue in the silence. Watching thoughts come and go, questioning their solidity, questioning even the thinker of them. Continue in silence, and when you are done, close with a prayer of gratitude.